Summary of the chapter prayer in Science and Health, considered from the standpoint of the capitalized synonymous terms for God which permeate this chapter. Gordon Brown, London, December 1969.
So our purpose now is to try to compass in our thought the message of the opening chapter, the prayer chapter. During the past few meetings, we've been following it, haven't we? The text of the chapter, paragraph by paragraph. Nothing out of context. Taking everything that is said into account, but realizing that the divine determinant of what appears on the surface of the text, the divine determinant of everything that's going on the surface of the text, as in our own human experience, relationship with each other, the individual in his relationship with his universe, is determined by the capitalized terms, because that's the representation of God. And so all the time we are focusing our attention on God. See, the glory of this revelation of the signification of the capitalized terms in Science and Health, the seven and the four, which give us the system, the science and the system of Christian Science, the glory of it, the glory of what they mean, is that each one of us begins in science to do that very thing which Jesus said of his own mission, his own identity, his own being. I come out from the Father, I come out from the principle, I come to the problem of mortality, I solve the problem of dualism, mortality, or whatever, and in so doing, I return to the Father, I return to the principle. But what it means, of course, is that never during the whole course of this cycle, this divine cycle of consciousness, do I leave the principle. All there is to me is the principle itself in operation, in individual expression. But that individual expression is not a segregated individual expression. It's only individual in as much as it is collective and universal at the same time. And this is the wonder of having a system of capitalized, synonymous views of the infinite. Because by reason of those terms, we begin, like Jesus, to come out from the principle instead of humanly endeavoring to work our way up to the principle. What is there to prevent us entering consciously now into the presence of mind, spirit, soul, principle, life, truth, love? Nothing but personal sense. Nothing but the sense of being a group of persons trying to get together and learn or know or understand a little bit more about truth than we knew yesterday or something like that. But that's just the personal sense of it. And it isn't even really an entering into the presence. It's the realization of the presence. And the nature of the presence of reality, of being, of truth, is that it is self-revealing as us, so that we find our identity individually in relationship with each other as the self-revelation of truth itself. I am that I am. And the introduction to this whole approach and the promise of this this realization that comes in the chapter prayer seems to me to be absolutely beyond words. So let's try and enter into the spiritual atmosphere, the spiritual message, the spiritual reality, the spiritual presence of everything, or at least what we are able to understand at the moment of the message of this chapter. From that wonderful introductory paragraph which begins the prayer that reforms the sinner and heals the sick is an absolute faith that all things are possible to God. And then the chapter unfolds and unfolds and unfolds through all 17 pages, not very long chapter, this opening one, until you get to this consummation of the whole idea of prayer or communion, communication, at one-ment, through what is called, or in terms of what is called, the Lord's Prayer. And I feel for myself that really and truly I've never known anything about the Lord's Prayer until pretty recently. Don't know very much now, but one has begun through this approach to the capitalized terms in their textual order, and therefore in their relationship to one another within their own order as the text unfolds them. Speaking for myself, I've begun to see things that I really have never seen before. That Lord's Prayer, my goodness, what a thing it is. The text says that the Lord's Prayer itself is really a sevenfold statement. It's the first seven statements of it that constitute the prayer itself. And then you come to that climactic eighth statement, which is added, apparently, or possibly has been added, but nevertheless becomes the eighth, the octave of those seven steps. And musically speaking, it is very beautiful, because just as the octave in the diatonic scale is the eighth note and is the first note, or what is called the tonic, simply sounded an octave higher, so really that eighth statement of the Lord's Prayer is the first statement sounded, as it were, an octave higher. And when it sounds, the door is wide open to atonement and Eucharist. There's no doubt about that. See, the first note of it is Our Father, Mother, God, all harmonious. Well, let's for goodness sake strike that now an octave higher, and it's the fact that Father, Mother, God, thine is the kingdom and the power and the glory forever. It's the same note, but it's really an octave higher. Father, Mother, God, the whole of being, universe, and all that it includes, the infinitude of identity, individuality, idea, quality, quantity, everything, thought, and everything that constitutes the universe of consciousness belongs to you, Father, Mother, God, and is never personally possessed. Therefore it is indestructible. Therefore it is unexpendable. And this is our endeavor, and our goal is to be at one with this truth consciously as man, so that being to us is unexpendable, indestructible. You cannot use it up, whether it's life or energy or strength or intelligence or joy or happiness, relationship. All a developing, multiplying, unfolding consciousness of reality because it all belongs to the principle and therefore is infinite. And the structure of the chapter is very beautiful, very simple, the way we're going to take it. We're not going into any depth of structure. That isn't our purpose in these meetings. But it's so simple and beautiful. If you take the opening paragraph, the opening sentence, it gives us the layout of the chapter, that the prayer that reforms the sinner and heals the sick is an absolute faith that all things are possible to God. All right. Therefore it is that because all things are possible to God, the sinner is reformed and the sick are healed. And this is the order of the chapter. In fact, the first few pages up to the top of page 5, it would seem, are really making it clear how it is, what it means that all things are possible to God. Why is this so? What does it mean? The first few pages up to the top of 5 really make that so clear. And then at the top of 5 comes starts the inevitable outcome of the fact that all things are possible to God, namely the prayer that reforms the sinner. And that goes over for quite a few pages until you get to the top of 12. And then you get the outcome of that, namely the prayer that heals the sick. The fact that all things are possible to God reforms the sinner. Firstly, heals the sick. Secondly, and you get this lovely threefold layout of the chapter, because that healing the sick is going to come through to the Lord's Prayer, of which it is said that it instantaneously heals the sick. Doesn't it? Those of us who would want to think about this point, or might want to think about this point, those three divisions into which the chapter so naturally and practically resolves itself, I think is awfully like the first tone of what we know today as the matrix, which corresponds to this chapter. The word in its own aspect is the word, where you get the three synonymous terms, mind, spirit, and soul, because it really has a great tone of mind as the chapter opens, and that leads into this tremendous mind where everything is at the point of origin and allness and so on. And then it blends into a great demand for purification. This is the reforming of the sinner, but in terms of the synonym spirit, it's purity and purification taking place. And then thirdly, when it comes to healing the sick, you're right in the tone and with the idea of what it is that constitutes the truth about body. And therefore, you're in the soul tone. There isn't much doubt about it, I think. So upon that background, can we just feel our way through the ideas as they come? See, there's nothing going on but the chapter itself, which is the principle revealing itself in terms of a specific idea of itself. We turn to the principle itself at this moment, individually, collectively. We enter into what the end of the chapter calls the closet, or the sanctuary. The closet is simply a symbol of where you get so close to reality that you can't get anything in between the idea and its principle, the human and the divine. In the closet, everything is so close that everything is understood to be one and indivisible. And as soon as this happens, sin goes out of the picture, disease goes out of the picture, death goes out of the picture, hate and fear and doubt and uncertainty and all the rest of it just is nowhere to be found there, because of the closeness, the coincidence of the human and the divine. All there is to the human is the divine in expression. And the message is really told us divinely through the particular unfoldment of capitalized terms in the text, in the order in which the text reveals them. And the first view of God, being, infinity, that we are called upon to entertain is the view of the infinite as mind. Now, during the last 2 weeks, we've been getting more acquainted with the text, perhaps, than we have been before. Is that true? And therefore, as these terms come one after the other, we'll just be turning over the pages, will we, and just following where they come in the text. Don't forget that each of the capitalized terms is a view of nothing less than infinity itself. All-inclusive infinity, nothing less than a view of universe itself. Which we do not approach through uncapitalized ideas. Otherwise, you're putting limits, it seems to me, on the capitalized term. We're starting out from the capitalized term, and that is leading us to the uncapitalized qualities and characteristics that we need to know, that we need to be, that we need to embody, that we find identity embodying as man. But it's from the terms, from the capitalized terms to the uncapitalized, and not vice versa. So the first view of the infinite that speaks to us is the infinite as mind. The text itself is an interwoven web or fabric of ideas. And if you think of it, if you could think of it as a beautiful fabric or something, it is studded with the gems of the capitalized terms. It scintillates with these aspects of divinity speaking to humanity, impelling themselves upon human consciousness, taking over control of human consciousness, so that no longer is human consciousness seemingly under the control of that which it cannot consciously control, seems unable consciously to control namely the involuntary happenings of the so-called unconscious, becoming conscious, and so on. Divinity, this is the divine reality of which the so-called psychological, mythological unconscious is the falsity, the myth, the unreality, the illusion. So the text really, I like to think at the moment, is just studded with these most precious stones, the capitalized terms. Mind is that which, we're told, it's that which molds, it's that which exalts, it's that which causes what the text calls unspoken thoughts, which are desires, and which are therefore the same as saying unformed thoughts. Mind takes these unformed thoughts, desires, providing that they are desires that are hungering after righteousness. No other kind of desires, but desires that are hungering after reality, truth, or what is called righteousness, and molds these unformed, elemental thoughts into form, causes them to take form so that they are no longer void. It's just like the Spirit of God moving on the face of the waters right at the beginning of the Bible, eliminating the darkness from off the face of the deep, which is just ignorance of the depths of reality, welling up, as it were, out of this text, but it isn't out of this text. It's welling up from the infinite to become consciousness, the consciousness which is man. And therefore, the human concept, is no longer spiritually without form or void of spirituality. It is being molded to take form, and the form that the human takes is the form of the Son of God, the form of man in the image and likeness of God. Now these desires on the part of the human, which seem as if they can be apart from the divine, as if the human, as the human, can desire the divine. It's not really true, that. The human as the human, as the human mind, can't desire the divine. It can only desire itself, because it can only really ever know itself. But under the impact of the divine itself, revealing itself to be the only reality of the human, these desires become the first touch of the coincidence of the human with the divine. It is the divine that is responsible, therefore, for these desires in the human. And therefore they are not really something that is taking place active in consciousness apart from the divine. And as we see that, then right at the beginning of the chapter comes this first touch of what the entire subject of Christian Science is all about, namely the coincidence of the human with the divine. the desire that goes forth hungering after righteousness is blessed of our Father, and it does not return unto us void. It takes on, it has been molded to take on the form. What before seemed to be unformed begins to have form, and that form is the beginning of the appearing of man as he is, the human, as man in God's image. The belief that the human is mortal, a thing of time, of birth and death and all the rest of it, is the ignorance or darkness upon the face of the depth of truth, the depths of reality, and is yielding to the impact of this that is called the Spirit of God revealing itself. Having just touched that idea, that idea of the infinite as mind, almost immediately we have to take into account a view of the infinite as love. And it's wonderful that that should be so, because mind and love, we could say, are the beginning and the end, the Alpha, the Omega, the first and the last of the order of the synonymous terms. It's like the arms of infinity reaching out and embracing infinity within its own grasp and consciousness and comprehension. Mind, we find, is love, because as soon as we touch this term love, he is unchanging wisdom and love. He has already done all. He already knows all. It is such a feeling of everything already accomplished. Being is already wholly accomplished. And this is the love tone. This is what is meant by the term love. The purpose of the term love is to convey to humanity this idea, this truth. And we see that this mind is love. And as soon as we see, therefore, that the end of the whole story, represented by this term love, is in fact from the beginning, where everything has its origin in mind, this is wisdom. Because there's no hope in all the world of thought, consciousness, understanding, unfolding from beginning to end, except the end is from the beginning. And so our first two terms are love, mind and love. The mind which is love, and the love which is mind, embracing the infinite within itself, being infinite. And therefore, how could we not be immediately brought to the idea of what constitutes the science of being? What we are engaged with, therefore, is the science of being. If you've got the terms underlined on these pages, then they stand out like these gems we were speaking of, and we can just follow them as they come down. We can see what constitutes the science of being from what has been conveyed by these two opening terms. Science of being with a little b, the science of man's being. The science with a capital S, the divine science, therefore, of man's being. the science of true human being. And what is it? It is the fact that love is mind, that the totality of being is accomplished from the beginning. It's known to the mind, which is love. The love which has already bestowed all good, it says there, already knows all. Therefore, this must be being. Nothing to do with used to be or going to be, which is all non-science and is just of the nature of mystical religion, but the science of being involves the idea that the infinite is already wholly, totally, 100% accomplished and is good. Nor can the infinite do less than bestow all good, since he is unchanging wisdom and love. And that good has the quality of goodness. And this goodness attains the demonstration of truth. And we're introduced to another capitalized term, which is truth. It attains the demonstration of truth. That man, this goodness, this quality of good, attaining unto truth itself, finding himself in and of truth, the demonstration of truth, truth demonstrating, demonstrare, to show forth. It's truth showing forth itself. This infinite mind, which is infinite love, which gives us this hint of the science of being, is truth showing forth itself as all good. And the quality of that all good, which is goodness, is man finding himself in and of truth itself. And it's all entirely the opposite of a circumscribed or circumscribing being. This is nothing to do with a circumscribed human being. No. What we are dealing with is uncircumscribed divine being, uncircumscribed divine mind. Mind uncircumscribed. This is divine being, the opposite of a circumscribed human being, and yet it's the truth about the human. Therefore, it's the true human being. It's the science of the true human, humanity as it is in truth, isn't it? So there the term mind comes again, and as soon as we see, as soon as mind reveals its uncircumscribed nature as truth, it's all spiritual growth. Spiritual growth's away. We're away. Spiritual growth. And there's nothing impeding spiritual growth. But the belief that the human is circumscribed impedes spiritual growth. Almost as if the text says, now, let's just take that wonderful development. Now let's just sum it up, because really what we're talking about all the time is the love which is mind. And so God is love, It's impossible to conceive of anything added to that view of the infinite. This alone is intelligence. There isn't any intelligence apart from this idea, these ideas. So love is mind, it's saying again. The infinite mind is already infinitely informed of everything. It knows everything. It already comprehends infinity within itself because it is infinity. This is mind. Our mind, man's mind. Because there's no other kind of mind really to have. And it's perfection. And it's an open fount, which is just the source of all existence and blessedness, and it's pouring forth this source, and it can't be impeded. This is the science of being. The being which is the same, changeless. Can you change the science of being? It's the same yesterday and today and forever, the science of being. Now, if it's a science, it's governed, it's controlled by a principle, and it's demonstrable, this principle, this science is demonstrable. And because it's a science, because it's governed by a principle, it's a spiritual mathematics, this whole subject. Mind, which is love, which is the science of being, which is truth showing itself forth, uncircumscribed mind, love, the totality of this all-comprehending, outpouring mind. We touched the idea of the principle, governing principle of the universe. His rule is already established. It's the principle of all that goodness, which is the expression of that all good that love has bestowed, already bestowed. The principle of that goodness. The work of this principle is already done. It's got a rule that's already established. The rule is that the end is from the beginning, and it's the rule that the unfolding of this end from the beginning is the unfolding of the idea from beginning to end. And this unfolding of the idea from beginning to end is the working out of the appearing humanly, is the working out of the whole problem of salvation. It wants to say it again. It wants to say, this is divine being that we're talking about. And man reflects it. Man is its reflection. And the reflection is included in the divine, capital D, capital B, being itself, with its science of being with a little b. The divine being, which is the one altogether lovely. And then, for our instruction, the finger is pointed. How empty are our conceptions of all this? The human concept of mind is so empty that it thinks of mind as something that's got to be informed and filled up with knowledge. What an empty conception of mind that is. And so we have, in belief, a human mind. An empty conception. Whereas, infinite mind is already infinitely informed, and then we can't give information to this infinite mind. Are we really grateful for the good already received? What good? The all good that love has already bestowed. That's the good that is already received. If it is already bestowed, it must be already received. It can't be partially received. But the fact that this good is a perpetual unfoldment, the fact that it's an outpouring fount, means that as man, it's a continual and a continuous receiving. The giving and the receiving goes on continuously, and so we're fitted to receive more. This is being grateful for life, truth, and love. This combination of life, truth, and love for the first time. This all good that is already received, for which it is imperative to be grateful, to accept, to be conscious of having accepted, is life, truth, and love itself. And if the heart is not very close to, so close that it's at one with, if it is far from divine truth and love, then the outcome of that is the ingratitude of barren lives. Now, the text isn't spelling it out at this point, but it's giving us a very substantial hint through this idea of an empty conception, which mustn't be an empty conception. It must be mind's own conception of itself, which is full of truth, full of the information regarding infinity. And this thought of otherwise barren lives, lives that are barren, lives that are infertile, lives that are unproductive, lives that are not bearing fruit. There's such a big hint at this point of the great signification of these two combinations of terms, life, truth, and love, and then truth and love. Empty, barren conception. Obviously, what is it all about? Well, we know, because we've come through really already, this is a review of the chapter as a whole, and having encompassed the chapter as a whole, we know that we're coming through in the end to the truth about father, son, and mother, and to the truth of infinity embodying, as the womb of consciousness, embodying within itself all truth. Love embodying within itself all truth. And the idea is already beginning to speak through these three very fundamental concepts of what is meant by the term father, what is meant by the term son, what is meant by the term mother, as one thing, not as three separate entities, but as life, truth, and love in one conception. One, this is the full conception of being, of the divine being. That being is life, truth, and love. This is the full conception. There's no emptiness there. And once that is seen in terms of truth and love, the infinite as love, embracing, embodying, showing itself forth in terms of truth, a truth about everything in one conception. We've really touched a fundamental idea. Because that truth and love is then life itself. And this is heartfelt gratitude. There is heartfelt gratitude when this idea speaks. And there's no question of not keeping the divine commandments. If you love me, keep my commandments. We are finding, the human is finding itself worthy to partake of love. The next term is love. To partake of love, to be partakers of love. Because it was hungering after righteousness, and because the fount was outpouring, because the all good was already bestowed by love, now the human is partaking of love, partaking of that all good, assimilating the divine character. Here is the human assimilating that which love is giving. It's partaking of it and assimilating it because of the righteous hunger for it. And the molding and the fashioning is going on, and the human is awakening in the likeness of mind, finding its mind to be infinite, finding its substance to be infinite, finding its identity to be infinite, finding its person and its universe and its harmony to be infinite, finding its life to be infinite, finding its form and its consciousness to be infinite, finding itself to be totally unrestricted, infinite in every way, awakening in his likeness. And it's the science of Christianity, we have to see, that is doing this. It's Christianity at work doing this molding. It's molding, fashioning all identity into one great embodiment. But of course it can't do it except it's a science. There's a science to Christianity in order that this should be so. The awakening that is taking place, therefore, from the Adam dream of father, son, mother, broken up. And this, of course, is regeneration on line 28. It's rebirth. And as we come up onto page 5, it's as if the fact that all things are possible to God has been explained. Why is it that they're possible? Because all things are already done. That's why they're possible. It's only a question of the self-revelation of what is already done, and therefore all is possible because it already is. And working from this standpoint, we can now come to the whole proposition of the reforming of the sinner. And immediately, almost immediately, we're led to the term Christ. Christ is the term that for the infinite that enters the picture now. The followers of Christ. The followers of Christ are saints. Nothing to do with goody-goodiness. Are saints in the scientific, spiritual sense. And Christ destroys sin. Why does Christ destroy sin? Because the great thing about Christ, mind you, all that we've been talking about through these capitalized terms up to this point, now we see that this whole thing is Christ. Doesn't matter whether it's been mind, love, science of being, truth, principle, love, mind, whatever we're being led to, life, truth, and love. It's all Christ. The totality of it, so we're led to the conception Christ. And Christ is that which destroys sin because the great fact of Christ is sinlessness. There's no element of sin in Christ, but it is a specific view of Christ that does this, and it's Christ, which is truth and life. Christ, truth, itself indestructible because sinless, therefore truth and life, that is it which destroys sin. And that is the Son of God. Now this whole thing is the Son of God. This Christ is the Son of God. And it comes to destroy the works of the devil. What is the works? If it destroys the works of the devil, the Son of God, then the Son of God must himself be the works of God, or the work of God, the work that is already done. His work is already done. His Son already is. His work is his Son. The Father and the Son. The Son and the Father, truth and life. And so it comes to destroy the belief that as man we can ever be taken away from the Father, Mother, God. Because the belief that we could be is sin. And that denies Christ. Therefore Christ, which is the truth that we cannot be and never have been, denies sin. And this whole thing is love. This is love. And this is it that corrects and governs man. Why does it do that? Because it's a principle. You see where we are at the top of page 6? Because it's a principle. It doesn't work personally, in other words. Men may pardon, but this principle reforms the sinner. You can see how we're into the section of the chapter where, because with God all things are possible, the sinner is reformed. And therefore we're reaching the harmony of being through understanding the divine principle of being. The whole thing is being the science of being with its principle of being. And the outcome of the science of being, or the expression of the science of being with its principle of being, is the harmony of being. And again we are reminded that the whole thing is love. And it's impossible to conceive of anything more than the fact that infinity, universe, is love. Can't ask him to be more. Higher we cannot look, farther we cannot go. And love's shows forth its mercy in this destruction of sin, this destruction of the belief that we could ever be taken away from
life, truth, and love, and segregated into personal bits and pieces called mortals. Christ, sinless Christ, destroys, wipes out this belief, because it isn't a happening, it isn't a thing, it isn't something that's happened. It's an illusion. So we're understanding love as principle coming down here. This love that has been revealing itself is principle, and therefore it impersonalizes everything. And it was Satan that bound the sick woman. But at the same time, don't be fooled, because except this sin appears to human sense as personality, it doesn't appear at all. And therefore, Peter, thou art an offense unto me if you don't allow this to take place in consciousness. If you don't allow the elimination of the mortal to take place in consciousness, thou, the personality, art an offense unto me. And all this time, therefore, it's the prayer that reforms the sinner, and it comes down page 7 to a view we've not been asked to take into account before in the textbook, and it's the view of the infinite as soul. Because what we must be shown now is that all this sin proposition and what we've touched and seen that it means is the opposite of soul. Physical sensation, material ecstasy and emotion, self-satisfaction, finding satisfaction in a belief that the self is mortal and all the rest of it. Soul enters the picture to dispel that aspect now, as it must. Emotional utterances and all the rest of it. And this soul, the infinite as soul, where we find spiritual sense, and it's spiritual sense that's guiding us on our journey, this soul must now be seen to be mind. Because what the human is seeming to do, wanting to do, is to establish a contact with the divine ear. But the divine ear is not an auditory nerve. It's nothing to do with physical sensation or nerve, the divine ear. What is it then? It is the all-hearing and all-knowing mind, to whom each need of man is always known and by whom it will be supplied. Soul is mind. You get such a feeling of what is meant by soul as we come down here through all this talk about hypocrisy and coming face to face, sinners coming face to face only spasmodically with their wickedness, holding secret fellowship with sin. These externals spoken of by Jesus as like unto whited sepulchres full of all uncleanness, because you've got in this proposition of hypocrisy, which is wearing a mask, covering up on the outside what is really going on inside, having a different inside from the outside, a sepulchre full of all uncleanness but beautifully whitewashed on the outside. All this is sin, and it's all the opposite now of soul. But this soul being mind is that which we've already seen knows already each need of man and being an open fount, pours forth each need. Can't do otherwise. And these pages, which have no capitalized terms in them, coming down page 8 and way on into page 9, it's the same theme of covering this multitude of sins. You can't have that in soul, because in soul the outside and the inside are the same. And turning away from the poor, if we turn away from the poor, we are not ready to receive the reward of him who blesses the poor. What are the poor? The poor are those who have no material possessions. That's why they're blessed, because they say, no, nothing belongs to me. And it'll come through at the end of the chapter, thine is the kingdom. It doesn't belong to me. And this is being poor in spirit. And as you see that, then you come over. You love your neighbor as yourself. You begin to obey that commandment. You're inside and you're outside. No whited sepulcher or mask. Therefore, you can love your neighbor as yourself, because it's all one self. But that self doesn't belong to me personally. It belongs to God. It's God's self. And therefore I'm poor, because it doesn't belong to me. But being poor in that way, my goodness, this is Christianity. And this is not only Christianity, it's the Eldorado of Christianity. It's the state of consciousness which is fabulous riches. Fabulous riches. This is the Eldorado. The golden city of Christianity, where the riches of being poor are fabulous. Isn't that wonderful? Well, we better just pause for a moment, because we've had the hour.